Tarlhurst End Podcast.
Read the blog
on thetarlhurstend.com.
Hello and welcome to a special Tarlhurst End Podcast where you can hear our interview with former Reading striker Stuart Lovell. I'll keep this very brief because I have packed up all of my audio equipment for the move from Tarlhurst End Towers, so the audio quality here isn't the best. Thankfully, you'll be relieved to know that the actual interview is much, much clearer. So apologies for this very brief, rough and ready link. But then again, what would you expect from such an unprofessional joke of a podcast? Just a very quick note to say that this interview was recorded before Reading's quarter-final with Crystal Palace. So there might be a few out-of-date references in there, but I'm sure you'll forgive us for those. And also, a very quick note to say our apologies that the Ibrahima Sonko interview has not dropped in podcast form. That's due to, again, it's some slight audio issues we had with the recorder. We didn't feel it was quite up to the standard that you've come to expect, even by our unprofessional joke of a podcast standard. So unfortunately, it's just going to stay in text form, but you can read the two parts that Ollie did with Sonks. They are up on the website now, so hopefully you'll tune into that. We'll be back in the next couple of weeks to continue on with this championship season. But in the meantime, here's what Archie had to say.
Get social with the boys.
Find them on Twitter
at the Tarlhurst End
and facebook.com/the Tarlhurst End.
Right, on this very special Tarlhurst End podcast, I'm delighted to be joined by another member of that fantastic Reading team that went up from the second division into the first division, came within a whisker of the Premier League. A man that scored plenty of goals along the way, one Mr. Stuart Lovell. Stuart, thanks very much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
As I said, thank you very much for taking the time to speak to us. Great to get another member of that fantastic team on. But I'm going to start at the very beginning. You were born in Australia, so how on earth did you end up in Berkshire?
Well, it was via Lacey Green, which is out near High Wycombe, and then we moved to a pub near Oxford. We came back from Australia when I was pretty young. I've got an older brother who's actually back out there now. He lives out in Melbourne. So I'm long overdue to go and visit him. My wife and kids are often nagging me to say we've got to go out and see Uncle Simon. So we'll do that in the next few years, no doubt. But when we came back, we settled in Reading from a pretty young age. You know, I was at Micklands Primary School, and then obviously went to Chilton Edge as a secondary school, and that was why it was a kind of natural progression, really, to join the local club and go through the academy all the way through to eventually to the first team.
We had a question I was going to say for later, but as you mentioned, Chilton, going to school there, we had a question from Will saying, how does it feel to be the second most famous person to come out of that school? Now a certain actress from Game of Thrones, Natalie Dormer's gone through it as well.
Yeah, how dare she? That's terrible. She's relegated me to an also-ran. I get that a few times from just, you know, still in touch with a few friends from school, and they say that your title has been well and truly taken. And I try and pretend as if I don't know who she is, but I do know. Well, I know of her. I haven't met her, obviously, but listen, I mean, it was good fun. You know, it was good fun going to Chilton Edge, and I was back at a friend's wedding a few years ago and had a look around the school, and everything seems so much smaller when you go back when you're grown up. Quite depressing, really, but good times. You know, I enjoyed it back then, and I think that we had an awful lot more freedom, as I remember it, when I was a kid. I wasn't great at catching the school bus in the morning, so occasionally I would have to make my own way from Caversham Park to Sonning Common, and I kid you not, I mean, back then I was hitching a lift sometimes, you know, but I think parents would actually shudder at the thought nowadays, but I just kind of thought, if you miss the bus, you can make your way there, no trouble. There's no way I would allow my kids to do that nowadays, but what my mum didn't know didn't hurt, I suppose.
Absolutely not. So how did you end up in the youth setup at Reading, and how did you get spotted?
Well, I guess I kind of started to make my name, at primary school level when I was at Micklands. My brother was a good footballer and had trials for Reading Reading District primary schools. So obviously Reading's a big place, you know, loads and loads of schools in the area. And Reading traditionally had always been a strong district team. So my brother had gone for trials. He'd managed to break into the B team of the district, which was, you know, some achievement because it's tons and tons of kids, you know, trying to make their way into the team. And he managed to get to the B team. So of course, being a younger brother, I thought, well, I've got to try and top that. So that was the intention. So I actually managed to get into the squad a year early. So even though it was an under 11s district team, I made it into the A squad as a 9 year old, you know, as an under 10. And then when I actually played with my own age group, that was when I kind of started to realize that, you know, I was pretty good and could play at a good level, got called up to play for the county. And the natural progression, I guess, was that Reading were one of the very first clubs in the Football League to have a proper academy set up. So when I left and moved to secondary school at Chilton Edge, I was asked by the club to go and train with their academy a couple of times a week. And that was where it started.
What were facilities like back then for someone going through the youth system? Obviously, today we see these shiny multi-million pound academies with dedicated pitches and things like that. What was it like going through the setup at Reading?
Pretty ropey, actually, when you put it like that. I mean, you know, it's a long time since I've been back to Elm Park or around that area. But, you know, fans who know what the ground used to be like will know behind the South Bank, there was a big kind of concrete area which they used to use as a car park on match days, but we used to use that concrete area as a training facility, you know, back as a 12-year-old. You know, I'm talking about the area right next to Royal's Rendezvous, you know, if you know, God only knows if that's still there. But
it is alas now a housing estate.
Is it? Yeah, yeah. I kind of guess that might be the case. But I think, you know, fans who you know, watch Reading back in the day and remember Elm Park and know the South Bank, they'll know the area that I'm talking about, you know, just effectively a big concrete, you know, rectangle, which was where we used to train, you know, as a 12 and 13 year old. And then a little bit later on, we ended up going out to train to Bisham Abbey. On Bisham Abbey had one of the best artificial pitches, you know, in the area. So we used to go and train there when I got a little bit older. And then, of course, back then you could only sign associate schoolboy forms when you were a 14-year-old. So that was when you really start to think, maybe I could make a career out of this. You know, when you got to 14, if you were still in the academy and they were still wanting you to come back, you know, you knew you were in the elite.
Yeah, I was going to say, at what point did you think, well, actually, I might make a career of this? Was there a certain age when you thought, do you know what, I'm actually better than a lot of these players?
I think probably, I mean, listen, I used to score a lot of goals when I was a kid, you know, when I played at my school team. I played for the primary schools, Reading primary schools. I couldn't tell you exactly how many I scored, but I've got a feeling it was over 50 in a season. And, you know, I'm sure someone would have broken that record now. They probably obliterated it, but, you know, it was, it felt like a good achievement at the time. And, you know, you got a sense of people around you who had been around the game a long time and knew, you know, a good player from an average one. So I was always being told by people that I respected that, you know, I had a chance of succeeding. I never felt that my attitude would be something that would let me down. So it was just whether or not I'm good enough. I mean, slowly but surely you start to come through the ranks, and when you start to play with schoolboy level, you know, you really, you know, it becomes quite ruthless and cutthroat, and you know, you need to be bigger and stronger than the rest. And I was probably quite a late developer, so physically it wasn't that easy for me because I was quite small, you know, when I was a kid. But, you know, I was good enough with the ball at my feet that you know, I was still able to hold my own. And then bit by bit, you know, I got to the stage where I thought, okay, the last 2 years at school, I'd already made my mind up that as long as I got offered an apprenticeship at Reading, that I would take it. And really, I was counting down the days, to be honest, just to you know, leave school and have a crack at professional football.
So who gave you that first contract? Was Ian Branford still there? Was it Ian Porterfield?
Yeah. Ian Branford was the first team manager when I was in charge. Stuart Henderson was head of youth, and Bobby Williams, you know, was effectively the guy that used to look after us with the academy. So they were all very good to me, all, you know, really influential in terms of giving me opportunities to come through the ranks. And yeah, I mean, Ian Bramford was in charge, but I guess between Bobby Williams and Stuart Henderson, they were the guys that selected the players from the academy, you know, to decide who was good enough to become an apprentice. And then, of course, you got your 2 years as an apprentice, you know, learning the ropes and trying to impress enough to actually get a professional contract with the first team squad at the end of those 2 years.
So you get that first professional contract. I don't know if you could, feel free not to tell us, can you remember what the wage was for that first professional contract?
I can assure you, I know exactly what it was. It was bizarrely a 2 year contract, which doesn't sound particularly sexy, but back then it was very, very unusual. I remember AD Williams, who was a year older than me at school. So AD and Scotty Taylor were you know, a year ahead of me. So AD was given a 2 year contract initially, even while he was still an apprentice, which was unheard of. So it kind of tells you that he was seen as being the next big thing. I think it was because he'd broken into the first team as a second year apprentice, which was some achievement. Scotty Taylor was he developed pretty quickly. So those two were the ones that I was kind of, you know, they were the ones that I was focusing on, thinking, okay, I know these guys, I've played with these guys for years, even though they're a year older than me. You know, that was really the focus, to think, okay, if they can cut it, hopefully I'm good enough as well. But my 2 year contract that I was offered, it was Ian Porterfield by that time who had taken over. Ian Bramford had left, Ian Porterfield came in, and he offered me a 2 year deal. Although I have to say, he actually told me at the time it was only a 1 year deal.
Ah, okay.
And it was only when I got the contract through the post, I showed it to my mum and said, I think they've offered me 2 years here.
Was she like, don't point that out to them?
Well,
decide it.
Yeah, my mum was too honest, so she said, no, we've got to ask.
And oh, no.
And Ian Portfield said, no, it is 2 years. You know, I think that, you know, if you rate a player, you've got to give him a chance to develop. So I was delighted, but it was, my basic wage was £90 per week.
Wow.
And believe it or not, I actually had an incentive-based contract where if I made an appearance for the first team, either starting or coming on a sub, I got an extra £100. So
wow.
I actually made more money from the appearance money than I did from the basic salary. But the good news, of course, was that I broke into the first team squad in my first season as a pro. And I forget exactly how many appearances I made, but it was probably somewhere between 35 and 40, I think, from the bench or starting. So, you know, even though I was still only on £90 a week, I was basically getting not far off £200 a week most of the time, because I was in the first team for a lot of that season.
Any extravagant purchases?
it was funny, because the very first time I got a proper salary, because we used to get paid, when you were on a lower salary, the younger players used to get paid weekly, but you used to get your bonuses and your appearance money at the end of the month. So I remember I actually got a wage packet given to me at the end of the first time I'd broken into the first team squad. And I remember having nearly £1,000 in a tiny little brown envelope. And I still didn't even have a car at the time. I was still getting the bus. So I remember getting two buses home from the stadium. Obviously, number 17 bus, you know, from the Tylers Road into town, and then from town back to Caversham Park. And I never took my hand out of my pocket, because I was thinking, someone's going to rob me. So I was literally just ready, thinking, it doesn't matter who comes on this bus, I'm going to fight till my dying breath if someone tries to rob me of my first proper salary.
As well you should. So you mentioned you break into the first team. In fact, I think you scored on your debut,
yeah,
didn't you?
I scored on my full first team, my full start, first team debut actually from the start was against Fulham, and we won 1-0 at Elm Park, and I scored on the 44th minute. I've actually got a picture of it somewhere in the house where I remember it was a ball that was played in from the left from George Friel, and Scotty Taylor came in to head it and, as usual, missed it. And given that I'd played with him for so long, I knew it, he would miss it, and it skidded past the left back, and I took a decent touch on my chest and then rifled it into the top, well, just over the keeper. Keeper came out, and I just thought I hit it with height. And it was a bit of hit and hope, to be honest, but I remember just kind of thinking, God, it's not meant to be that easy.
Yeah.
And I mean, you literally couldn't make it up for a better debut. You know, if you're good, you want to score on your debut, you want to win. And if you can win 1-0, I mean, who else is going to get the headline? So it was perfect, really.
So you score, I said, on your first full start against Fulham, and then you're in and around the first team from that point on. Ian Porterfield leaves the club and Mark McGee comes in. Now, the thing with Mark was he was a player manager and also he was a striker as well. Was that a good thing for you? Or was that, you know, having a mentor around the place? Or was it like, oh, well, there goes my chance in the first team?
Well, it wasn't good for me initially. I mean, I remember that when he first came in, he was obviously trying to pick a team, and I think that I must have been in the first team when he came in. So he picked more or less the same team. I forget who the first game that, you know, that we had when he took over, but he left me in the first team, and then he was walking around, and someone kept saying Archie, Archie this, Archie that, and he turned around and he said, "Who's Archie?" And I said, "I'm Archie." Yeah. And he said, "I thought you were Stuart." I said, "Yeah, I'm Stuart, but my nickname's Archie."
Well, that's a very good point. I should have brought this up at the start. Where did Archie come from?
So it was a nickname I was given by the irrepressible Bobby Williams, who is one of the nicest guys I've ever come across in professional football, and still, you know, a good friend to this day, and someone that I would say had a huge influence on my career, as he did with a lot of the guys that came through from my era. You know, AD would tell you that, Scotty Taylor, you know, James Lambert, all these guys would say that, you know, Bobby was an absolute gem. When I first started training with the academy, you know, he hadn't quite worked out that I was a striker, because they just kind of said, oh, well, you know, you play where you play, but we're going to develop you as footballers. So when we used to do some matches occasionally, they would kind of stick me out wide on the right. And, you know, we had a training session where, you know, I didn't do particularly well, and we came in at the end and he said, "Archie Lovell." And I said, "No, it's Stuart." He said, "No, I know it's Stuart." But he said, "I used to play with an Archie Lovell at Bristol Rovers, and he was the worst player I ever played with in my life." He said, "So now you are Archie Lovell." And I remember thinking, that's not really a compliment. And the name stuck. He called me Archie from, so this would have been, I guess I was what, 11 or 12. And the name stuck. He just kept calling me Archie. And then as I came through the ranks, you know, signed schoolboy forms, and then all the way through, the name Archie stuck, to the point that when I, you know, when I became an apprentice and then turned pro, that was it. That was what I was known as. And every manager after that, you know, was told, "No, it's Archie." You know, that's what he's known as. I mean, it, bizarrely, the name, you know, people would think, oh, was that just something that, did you shed that when you left Reading? And the answer was no. I mean, it followed me all the way up to Scotland.
Excellent. So, well, Mark doesn't get the memo then. So he doesn't know your nickname to start with, and he's coming and he's taking your spot. So, as you were saying, initially it wasn't a good thing for you.
No, it wasn't a good. I mean, I think I've got to know Mark pretty well, and obviously, you know, he's up here, you know, managing Motherwell, and you know, I've you know, see him in a quite a different way now. It's not just a former manager; it's someone that I've interviewed, you know, when I was working with Satanta, and got to know socially as well. So it's quite bizarre, kind of looking back on that relationship from a long, long time ago. But he had left Newcastle. I think he'd been released by Newcastle when Ozzie Ardiles was manager, and I got the impression that it burned him, because he was 35. He probably knew deep down that he, you know, his playing days were almost over. But like most players at that age, you know, you cling on to every day that you can. You know, you want to try and prolong the career as much as you can. And he was very keen to keep playing and managing. And if I'm honest, I felt that, you know, while he was still trying to do both, it was a bit of a struggle. It was a struggle for us, and it was a struggle for him. I felt, looking back on it, that the time that he chucked the towel in terms of playing and just concentrate on managing, I thought there was a massive improvement in terms of his managerial skills, and also for us as a squad, because he gave it his fullest attention. And I thought we improved rapidly, you know, when he stopped playing.
Well, that's just it. I mean, the team, initially you had a few sort of top half finishes, but it's then the 93-94 season that it all seems to click into place. You're partnered up alongside Jimmy Quinn, and the both of you score 60 odd goals as Reading absolutely romp their way to that Division 2 title. What made that team special, especially in that first season, in that Div 2 championship winning year?
Well, I think it was a classic classic mix of youth and experience. You know, we had good legs in the team. You know, he maybe didn't necessarily know it at the time, but the lads who had come through the youth ranks, you know, specifically AD, Scotty Taylor and myself, were good players, you know, and went on to have long careers. So we, you know, we were very capable, even though we were kids, really, as far as they were concerned. But you had guys like Jimmy Quinn, who was a, you know, phenomenal goal scorer, and actually a very, very good you know, target man. You know, he had a lovely first touch, really good link-up play, very good in the air, and a phenomenal finisher with both feet. So, you know, I mean, let's be honest, he scored 40-odd goals that season, and that, you know, that was the fulcrum for the team. But we had good legs around the pitch. We had really good pace. You know, Michael Jilks playing out wide, that was a good outball for us. Competitive midfield. And, you know, with Phil Parkinson and Mick Gooding and a phenomenal goalkeeper in Xhaka. So we had a really good balance, I think.
Yeah. And as I said, you storm your way to the title that season, under Mark. The following season, you just pick up exactly where you left off. A little bit of a slow start. You have that defeat at Wolves, but from that point, you don't really look back. You're going great guns all the way through the season. Then in December, Mark leaves for Leicester. Now, what impact did that have on the squad and the team when Mark left the club?
Well, I mean, I can only speak for myself. I was immensely disappointed because I felt that I'd got to the stage where I was a virtual certain starter. So when you're playing for someone that knows you, can get the best out of you, you know, it was a disappointment, you know, for him to leave, because you don't know who's going to come in. I guess the guys who aren't in the team are probably quite happy because they think, you know, we all start off on an even keel, whereas the guys who are in the team and playing regularly are maybe, you know, slightly more concerned. But it was a bizarre situation, because I think the chairman and the board at that time didn't really know what to do. I mean, it's a little bit hazy now about what happened, but I'm pretty sure that they approached, I mean, God only knows, it sounded like half the squad, but they spoke to AD as club captain. They spoke to Jeff Hopkins, Phil Parkinson, and you know, I don't even know how involved Jimmy Quinn and Mick Gooding were at that stage initially. I think it was almost like...
It was a committee, wasn't it?
Yeah, chuck all the balls in the air and see what comes up. I think at the time, AD felt that he was too young. You know, he said, look, I'm too young to kind of take this on. And I think he was right. I think Jeff Hopkins was coming back from injury. He wanted to concentrate on that. And I think Parky was sensible enough to realise that, you know, Jimmy Quinn and Mick Gooding, their noses would have been out of joint if they weren't involved. So I think by default, it kind of landed on their lap. I'm not sure how much I would have said that either of them were management material, if I'm honest. And particularly Mick, who never showed any interest in coaching or anything like that. He was just a phenomenal squad player, very popular with the lads, and just, you know, just not someone who was particularly fussed about the tactical side of the game. He just had great experience. But the job went to the two guys as you know, joint player managers, caretakers initially, and then because we had a good run of results under them, the chairman thought, well, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, and he gave it to them permanently, which I can kind of understand why they did it. I'm not sure it was the best move in the long term, but it certainly worked for the rest of the season anyway.
Do you think you would have gone up that season if Mark had stayed?
Difficult to say. I mean, I think that, let's not forget, you know, we were hamstrung to a certain degree, and that was the only season I can ever remember in the history of football in England that the top two didn't go up. You know, don't forget, we finished second that year. So the Middlesbrough won the league under Brian Robson in their last season at Ayresome Park, and they were a very good team. They actually, I remember Brian Robson saying, Reading were the one team we couldn't really get to grips with. And I knew that he tipped us to win the playoffs when we got into them. But we knew at the start of the season that only one went up automatically and then the rest through the playoffs. You know, the only way we would have gone up was to win automatically or win the playoffs. And let's be honest, we should have won the playoffs anyway. So I don't know whether it would have made any difference. I think we would have been a better team, you know, if Mark had stayed there. But we certainly weren't a bad team after he left.
So Jim and Mick take over. Jimmy, you've obviously been playing again. The two of you had started the season as the preferred strike combo alongside Uwe Hartenberger. But around January time, they make a signing. They bring in Lee Nogan from Watford. And he, again, he just hits the ground running. And you two form a really good little partnership. What was the difference playing with Lee compared to playing with Jimmy?
Well, mobility is the long and the short of it. I mean, Lee was quick. He was quick. He was a good link-up. He kind of understood. I mean, I guess there are just some players that you just kind of click with. And we did, you know, we just kind of understood about the runs that each other were making, that we, you know, if one went short, one went long, and you knew when to kind of play around the corner and get it back. And I think we were both hard workers. That was the thing that I liked about him. You know, I always felt that when I played up with Jimmy Quinn, you know, respectfully, I was probably the one that was doing the lion's share of the grafting, you know, the channel runs and all this type of thing. And he stayed in the penalty box because that was his bag. With Lee, he was a lot more, comfortable to share the load. And you did kind of feel like it was an equal partnership. He hit a purple patch. You know, he scored a lot of goals in a short period of time. And it kind of reinvigorated me because I'd had an all right first few months of the season, but I felt I was a better player in the last few months playing up front with him.
Yeah, there are two games in that run-in that really stick out for me. It was my first season as a fan. The first one, and we've had a lot of questions in on this, is your hat-trick against Swindon. Lovely sunny day at Elm Park. The question we've got from a fair few people is, you did a bit of a cheeky celebration for one of the goals, mocking Swindon's main hitman at the time, Jan Agerfjordtoft. A couple of people have asked to say, was that pre-planned?
No, is the answer. You'll laugh at this. I'm actually looking at the picture now. I've got a picture. This, you know, probably sounds like I've kept loads of pictures from my career. I really haven't. I've hardly got any. But I think it was one of the local photographers actually blew the picture up for me and framed it. And it's got its pride of place in my office. So it wasn't pre-planned. I guess that, you know, because Fjordtoft had this, you know, special celebration.
Yeah, for those younger fans who might not remember him, to describe it for us.
Well, he pretended to be an aeroplane is probably the best way to describe it. I don't know whether that's how it looked to me anyway. It was a bit of a daft celebration, but he did that. And, you know, he was their top man. You know, he was their top goal scorer and he was the kind of the talisman of the team, if you like. And, we beat them 3-0 that day and we pummeled them. And I remember thinking, right, I can maybe rub their noses in it a bit more here. A bit cheeky, but you do that when
against
you're
against Swindon, that is fine. Absolutely acceptable.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it was, I've got a good memory of that game of the hat trick. You know, it was a left foot finish, right foot penalty, and then a right foot shot from about 20, 25 yards. So it was, it was a good one. It was a, you know, winning 3-0 and getting a hat trick. I mean, that, you know, doesn't get much better than that when you're playing up front, in a local derby.
Well, I'll one up you that with that point. The 3-1 win at Tranmere in the first leg of the playoffs. As you mentioned, we finished second. We go up there. We get Tranmere in the playoffs. The team, you know, they've got good players. They've got, you know, John Aldridge and players like that. Reading, not necessarily favourites. We go up there, and to this day, you know, I've watched the video back a couple of times. It is one of the finest away performances I think I've ever seen Reading play. Did it feel that good to be on the pitch?
Yeah, it did. It did, yeah. I must admit, I wasn't really someone that suffered from nerves, but I remember thinking, you know, we haven't really got any room for mistakes here. You know, if you have a bad 45 minutes in the playoffs, it tends to be enough to knock you out. So I felt quite nervous going into that game, and my wife's actually from that neck of the woods, so all of her family are Tranmere fans. So I remember kind of thinking, being particularly motivated to do well, and we took the lead. Lee Nogan did a lovely piece of skill, pirouette, and laid a ball into my path, and it set up really sweetly. And I just thought, you know, there's one place this is going to go, and caught a volley really, really nicely, hit across it into the bottom corner. And I remember the two of us just, we absolutely ran them ragged that day. I felt that was the one time where we, as a partnership, we were responsible for we won the game. The two of us won the game. You know, we were absolutely on fire that day. And 3-1 flattered Tranmere. You know, we probably should have won four or five, and the tie should have been buried. But as it turned out, it didn't matter. You know, we did what we had to do in the second leg, and you know, made it through to the final.
Yeah, we spoke to Shaka fairly recently as well, and he described that 0-0 as his favourite 0-0 and possibly his favourite ever game at Elm Park, just for the atmosphere.
Yeah, it was brilliant. I mean, it was. I guess there was a lot of pressure on us at that stage because, of course, everyone kind of thought, "Well, it's done. You know, you win 3-1 away from home. There's no way you're going to give that away." Shaka actually made a phenomenal save from. It wasn't Aldridge. It was the big chap who played up front, whose name escapes me. Oh, but you know, you can Google it and see. Now, but yeah. he was a big ugly brute who played up front. I remember he connected with a header from about 6 yards, and I remember thinking, oh God, this is them back in it. And Shaka pulled off an incredible save, and I think that seemed to just knock the stuffing out of them. They thought, God, if we're not scoring from there, we're not going to score at all. And we just managed to, you know, control the game and see it out. And then, of course, you're thinking, right, well, you know, we're really in a great position here, you know, just potentially 90 minutes away from the Premier League.
And we have to, unfortunately, bring up Wembley. Now, we will come on to the moment in a little while. But just before that, I mean, it's a fantastic day. Sea of blue and white. I said I was very young at the time. I think I'd just turned 9. But I just remember a sea of blue and white down Wembley Way. Just an amazing atmosphere. I mean, how were you nervous on the morning of the final, or were you just soaking it all in?
No, I was really nervous. And again, you know, I think that the enormity of the occasion kind of struck me when we were driving, when we were close to Wembley, when you saw the amount of fans that were there. And we were doing the old FA Cup route where the bus goes in underneath the stadium, and you were thinking, God, this is for real. And then I'd been to Wembley a couple of times before to see games, but I'd never played there before, and to actually just go around the place. I would like to have actually gone to the dressing rooms and stuff like that beforehand, because when you're going there, you end up almost being like, you know, someone who's being given a guided tour, and you're thinking, no, you know, we're here for a reason. We're here to do a job. But I was just like any other person who went to Wembley for the first time. You're kind of in awe of it. The nerves really didn't settle down at all until about 5 or 10 minutes into the game. You know, I did really feel it that day, and that was unusual for me. It hadn't really happened much before, and didn't happen much since. But it was a huge game. I mean, I don't know what they call it now. What is it, the 100 million or 120 million pound game? I don't know what it was worth back then, but we knew the enormity of what we were trying to achieve.
And to be fair, we started that final sensationally. And we've got a question from a guy who's Loyal Royal on Twitter. He says, I reckon Lee Nogan's goal is the most underrated Wembley goal ever. What does Archie think?
Yeah, it was a brilliant goal. Yeah, it really was. It was funny because I work with the PFA now up in Scotland, and I'm around the clubs a lot. And you would laugh because some of the people that were actually playing for Bolton that day, you know, I see Alan Stubbs regularly.
Boom.
And Mixu Patline's actually a good friend of mine.
Oh.
And it's funny because you know, I guess that fans just remember everything about big games, whereas players maybe, I don't know, maybe it kind of becomes a distant memory, you know, for some. But I remember a lot about the game, and I do remember that goal. And it was, you know, he was the type of player that Stubbs found it difficult to play against, someone who was quick and sharp and mobile, and lovely turn and brilliant finish. You couldn't really have had a better start to the game. And that was when I settled down. I thought, God, you know, we're a very good team when we're in front. We were good front runners generally. And I thought I felt if we got another goal, I generally didn't see us getting beaten that day.
And we did. Adey Williams pops up again, a really nice little finish. We're 2-0 up, going great guns. And then Tilksy gets brought down in the area. Another question from Matt. He says, did the ref bottle it by not sending off Jason McAteer, who was already on a yellow, I think, by that point?
Yeah, I mean, I think I think nowadays you would expect. I mean, you know, I think they're more rigid in terms of what they demand of officials, and they make it very clear about you know, what officials would do. Could he have been sent off? Should he have been sent off? Yeah, I think he probably could have and should have. But I mean, I wasn't really giving that much thought, to tell you the truth, because I thought we were so dominant in the first half. I thought, I'll just get the ball, stick it on the spot, tuck it away, 3-0 going at half time, and then we can just kind of recharge and see the game out. And it didn't really, I guess this is where a lot of people wonder about preparation for penalty takers and stuff like that, because I had never really given much thought to us getting a penalty in the game, which might sound silly, but it's probably something I should have done. But the first time I thought about what I was going to do with it was literally when I was putting it on the spot. And the problem is they always say you should never change your mind. My favourite penalty was I could hit at like a firm Matt Le Tissier to the keeper's left, and usually in the top corner. I was really good at that. You know, I practiced it a lot, and that was my favourite penalty. And that, when I put the ball down, I thought, that's what I'll do. And then as I was walking back, bizarrely, I thought to myself, I took a penalty against Swindon only a few weeks ago. You know, they will definitely have done video footage, and they would have checked things like this for a game of that magnitude. You know, loads of time to prepare. And I suddenly just thought, the guy will have told him that he puts it to the keeper's left. So I suddenly convinced myself that he'll dive to that way, I'll put it the other way, and, you know, job done. So I was absolutely convinced when I ran up. I just thought, I'd been really smart. I'm going to hit it. He thinks I'm going to his left, I'm going to go to his right, and I'll send him the wrong way. And I think because of that, I just, you know, took a little bit off it in terms of not being as precise as I should have been. Hit it hard, but hit it a really good height for the goalkeeper. And I was so shocked when he saved it that Mick Gooding actually read, you know, he did what any good midfielder would do. He followed up just in case the keeper spilled it, which he did. He knocked it back to me. And to be honest, I was in a daze. I was kind of very flat footed. And when he actually gave me a second bite of the cherry, which I really should have scored as well.
I was going to say, that was almost an easier chance than the penalty itself.
It was a sitter. It was an absolute sitter, but I just wasn't prepared for it, and again, kind of made a hash of that. I have to be honest, I did kind of think to myself at the time, I really hope that doesn't come back to bite me, because I just thought, you know, we've been so much on top. You know, it's a game that should be in the bag, because 2-0 is a funny score. It is a funny score, because you know that if a team gets one goal back, invariably they get a lift and you tend to drop deep and panic a bit. And at three, I thought, well, three, we were home and hosed. You've no idea how much that penalty miss would eat away at me in the months after, maybe even longer than that, but certainly a long, long time. Where I used to, you know, lie in bed at night thinking about it. But what can you do? I mean, you know, you just try and do the best that you can. I did feel that it affected me in the second half. I didn't feel like I had great focus, and we as a team just didn't play as well. And it gave them the impetus to come back. I guess the one thing, if I could defend myself to say that we still should have won the game, was that with 12 minutes to go, we were still 2-0 up. Yeah. You know, and did my penalty cost us? Yeah, it probably did. Should we have won the game anyway? Yeah, I think we should have.
If you had said a scenario where you can be 2-0 up going into the start of the second half, regardless of the scenario, you would have taken it.
Yeah, well, and you take it a step further, you're 2-0 up with 12 minutes to go, you would snatch someone's hand off. But we were kind of running on empty. We had quite a few guys that day who had taken injections. I remember Keith McPherson, you know, Macca had a problem with his toe, I think.
It was broken, wasn't it?
Yeah, he had a fractured toe, and he had an injection, which ironically they last for approximately 90 minutes, roughly. And I remember thinking, God, if we go into extra time, that's going to start throbbing. Andy Bernal was struggling. Lee Nogan was struggling. So we were the walking wounded to a certain degree. And in my head, I was just thinking, God, if this goes to extra time, we're toast. And unfortunately, we made a couple of errors. Jeff Hopkins came on as sub for Andy Bernal, and Andy had dealt with the aerial threat of Bolton really well. And Jeff got out, jumped at the far stick by, I think it was Owen Coyle. And then Darius tried to nip in front of De Freitas, that was Darius's style. As a centre half, always taking chances, and you know, he rolled him and then sclaffed a shot past Xhaka, and that was when I thought, oh God, I know which way this is going.
Yeah, and unfortunately it went that way. I mean, we lose 4-3 in the end, and it's a deflating feeling. I mean, won't relive it. I mean, any fan, and for yourself, it just must have been amplified 10 times round. But the summer comes around, and key players are sold. I mean, was losing Xhaka, Scotty, and Simon Osborne, did you really think, was there a sense that you could go again? Or did you think that when those big three went that, well, there's only one way from here?
Yeah, I was worried. I mean, I was worried for the quality of players that we lost. If I'm honest, I was also worried that playing under Jimmy Quinn and Mick Gooding again. And I know that sounds an awful thing to say, but, you know, we had managed to get to the final, playoff final, and had finished off the season well. But I would say it was because of the quality of the squad more than the quality of the management. And it's nothing against those two. I mean, I'd like to think that it's water under the bridge now, but there was no way that the chairman or the board could part company with them, because of, you know, on paper it looked like they'd done a fantastic job, but, you know, I wasn't convinced they were the right people. So they certainly weren't the right people to get the best out of me. So I guess maybe I'm talking selfishly, but I wasn't convinced that it was a good partnership, and we lost some great quality. And then, I mean, it was ironic because I had offers to leave the club in the summer. And, you know, I remember someone who shall remain nameless, but a very good source told me that, you know, the club turned down a significant bid.
Wow.
from a club, you know, that normally you would say was a bigger club than Reading. But this was back in the day pre-Bosman. And, you know, this was back where you couldn't just kind of say, well, I'm out of contract, I can leave. You know, if a club offered you a contract, they retained right to compensation. And the only way you could leave was if the club agreed to the compensation. If they didn't, you could go to a tribunal. But of course, it was early days then. No one really knew how the tribunals would work. So a club, you know, made us a very high six-figure offer, and which I believe was turned down. And I didn't even hear about this at the time. I heard about this a long time afterwards, maybe even when I left. I can't remember now. But would I have left if I was given the chance? I don't think I would have done, because of the guilt, to be honest. I just felt personally responsible for not winning the playoff final. So I dare say I would have stayed anyway.
Well, Dave brings up a really nice point. The penalty after the Wembley miss, you had one at home to Luton, the South Bank in unison chanting your name before the penalty was taken. How did you feel stepping up to take that one?
Do you know, the funny thing is, I knew I was going to score because it didn't matter. you know, I think that was the thing that people said to me, oh, did you miss because you were nervous and this and that? I missed because I was too smart for my own good. If I'd have hit my normal penalty where I normally hit them, you know, I dare say I would have rifled it in the top bin and we would have won the game. But I, you know, I changed my mind. What did I do when we got the penalty against Luton? I just I went back to doing my usual penalty and rifled it in the top bin. So, yeah, I mean, it was to say it was scant consolation is an understatement. Anyway, I mean, that's the way of the world, isn't it? You know, football's not always a fairy tale.
Yeah, and you're at the club for another couple of years. I mean, 95-96 was a decent enough year for you. And then things just started to trail off after that season for you. I mean, the best moment, I suppose, from a Reading fan point of view, watching you at that time, was those two last-minute goals against Wolves, which to this day still sends, you know, chills for remembering the atmosphere and stuff that day. I mean, again, that was against a team that Mark was managing at the time. What do you remember about those couple of goals?
Yeah, quite a lot, actually. Yeah, I mean, because they were later than late. You know, people would say to me, oh, what was the earliest, what was the quickest goal you ever scored? And they say, what was the latest goal? And I say, well, I scored after 14 seconds for Hibs and I scored after 97 minutes for Reading. So, I wouldn't say, funny enough, the winning goal was nowhere near as good as the first one. The first one was actually really good anticipation and a great finish from a tight angle. The second one, I actually hit a volley and it I think it hit the centre half and kind of spun up and came back to me, and I didn't even catch it that well, but the goalkeeper was unsighted and it just kind of trundled into the corner. And I remember I've got a great picture, that a friend of mine had shown me on the internet of me, you know, celebrating with Martin Williams, and I look like I'm about 10 feet in the air. It was great times. And I remember walking off, I was going down the tunnel, obviously the game was at Elm Park, and AD was waiting for me at the bottom, because of course he was at Wolves at the time, he was standing there, and he couldn't smile because obviously all the Wolves players were coming in looking pretty shamefaced that they chucked away a goal lead into injury time. But he just kind of gave me a little nudge and said, "You jammy." which was quite nice.
Well, 1997, again, not unfortunately a great year for you. You pick up a significant cruciate injury. That I've read you thought at times that it might have been the end of your career. Did you ever really fully come back from that, do you feel?
I played a lot of games. I guess that was, it turned out that was almost halfway through my career. But it was, at the time, it was a very serious injury. I mean, it was the same one that Gazza suffered, in the cup final for Spurs at Wembley. And anterior cruciate ligament operations were seen to be career threatening at that stage. It was a very serious operation. I actually went up to Droitwich to have it, have the operation in a knee clinic there. And the surgeon, who was a South African guy, he actually videoed it and he showed me the operation, which I don't recommend because when you see yourself lying like a slab of meat on a bench, having surgery, you basically look dead because obviously you're knocked out with the anaesthetic and white as a sheet. And he showed me, what he did, and there was lots of blood and gore and whatnot. And I said, "Why are you showing me this?" And he said, "Well, you need to see the severity of the injury and what we've had to do to be able to help you to walk again, never mind bend your knee or run or do anything else." So that kind of hit home that I would have to work really hard to get back fit, which was not a problem for me. But I did feel that I lost a little bit of mobility. I never got the full bend back in my knee. Fortunately for me, I was never the quickest anyway, so it wasn't as if I lost lightning pace like Michael Jilks or something like that. I lost a little bit of mobility, but did it stop me? I don't know what it did. I guess you just kind of make do, really. You suffer an injury and you come back as best you can. And I still played another, well over 200 games after that with Reading and Hibs and Livingston and Queen of the South. So, I played a lot of games after that.
Your Reading career, unfortunately, for us, came to an end in that 97-98 season. After, you came back from the injury, tried to do your bit, but the club gets relegated first under, Terry Bullivant, and then lately under Tommy Burns. Did you know, at what point did you sort of think that your time at Reading was coming to an end?
To be honest, if I hadn't of suffered my cruciate ligament injury, I would have left that summer. This was right at the end of the season in 1997. And I remember playing at Main Road, and we were 2-0 up against Man City, and we managed to lose 3-2. I think I came off injured during that game. And or at least I felt I was injured. They subsequently decided that I could play a couple of days later at Slough Town, which is where I did my cruciate. So, that was that stuck in the throat a little bit. But I was absolutely, determined that was my last season. I was really not getting on too well with the two joint player managers. And I thought, if they're going to be here next year, I'm not. So had I not have suffered the injury, I would have left. As it turned out, I suffered, the cruciate, and the club were at least kind enough to keep me on, for the following season while I came back from surgery, and then I played. I can't even remember how many games I played in the second half of the season, but I was a bit of a bit part player, really.
You still scored a winner over Swindon. That's all that mattered.
Absolutely, yeah, I did. Yeah, I remember that, and I it was funny because. It was horrible. That was the only time I was part of a team that got relegated. And if I'm honest, I didn't really feel part of the team because I hadn't played very much. And the team had started to play poorly long before I came back into the squad. It wasn't a great squad. we didn't have a we didn't have great leadership from the manager, Terry Bullivant, at the time, who was a nice guy, very good coach, but not a strong manager. And then by the time Tommy Burns came in, I think we were on the slippery slope.
Yeah, and it ends, I said, the season ends in relegation. Did Tommy want to keep you, or was it sort of a mutual decision to move on?
I mean, I think the thing is, he initially we didn't really see eye to eye because I'm not sure who he was taking his information from, but I think he had spoken to a couple of people in and around the club, and for one reason or another, the information that he was given was that I was dead wood. The good thing for me was that, you know, I was able to kind of prove otherwise and managed to, you know, at least get back into the team under him. And we left on very good terms. He, you know, we had a meeting. He said to me, "What are you thinking?" I said, I need to leave. You know, I said, I've been here too long. I'm becoming stale. I need a change. And he said, for what it's worth, I agree. He said, if you wanted to stay here, I would have been happy for you to stay. You know, you're very popular with the fans. And he said, and you're a good player and a hard worker. But he said, for what it's worth, I agree with you, you know, and I wish you well. So he asked me what I was thinking of doing, and I'd mentioned at the time that I had a few options, and he actually said, you know, you might consider going up to Scotland. I think you might like it there. So, you know, that kind of planted a seed, and, you know, and the rest is history.
I was going to say, how did the move to Hibs come about? Was it, did they approach you, or was it through your agent? Did that move come?
I didn't really have an agent at the time, to be honest. There were very, very few times in my career that I used one. I actually ended up using one on that occasion purely on the basis that I didn't know what the wage structures were like in Scotland. But bizarrely, it was actually Darius. It was Darius Dovcek who contacted me and said, there's a guy that who was an agent who did my deal from Legia Warsaw to Celtic. And, you know, he knows the Scottish scene very well. So if you're thinking of going up there, give him a buzz. So I contacted this guy, and he introduced me to Alex McLeish, set up a few days training up in Edinburgh. And yeah, I mean, Edinburgh's, I don't know if you've ever been there, but, you know, anyone who hasn't, you should go, because it's just
beautiful city.
Beautiful place. And I got to the stage, you know, at that time in my career, I was thinking football's not all it's cracked up to be. You know, you need to have, you know, some downtime, and you need to be living in a place that you really like. And my wife and I decided that, you know, it'd be good to get a real change. If we were going to move, let's move and go the whole hog. And so, you know, Hibs was not a great club at the time in terms of where they were, for now they'd just been relegated. But Alex McLeish was very convincing. You know, he said to me that, he said, listen, you know, come here, play. He said, we'll win this league. We'll win it in a canter. We'll get promoted back to the Scottish Premier League. And he said, and you're the type of player that I know can play in that league. He said, some of these won't be here then, but he said, you will be. So give me a year, see if you like it. And if you do, you know, we can take it from there. And we had a very slow start to the season, ironically, but by the time we got to end of January, we were about 20 points clear. And we did win the league by a country mile. And it was a revolution for me, because that was the first time that I ended up playing in a different position, really, other than striker. You know, he dropped me back into midfield, attacking midfield, which suited me well. And I had a good season, scored 12 goals from midfield, and we won the league very well. And that was, you know, that was quite an enjoyable season, particularly on the back of having just been relegated with Reading.
I was just going to say, before we touch on more on your career in Scotland, was there a bit of regret? Did you ever have any regrets that you didn't get to play at the Medeski Stadium? Obviously, you would have seen it being built just before you left the club. Did you kind of wish you'd maybe got a couple of games in there?
I mean, I think the thing is, I was so intent on leaving that that the stadium was largely irrelevant. I mean, I did get to play in it. I played in Parkey's testimonial. And I'm trying to think. I think
2002 wasn't it again?
Yeah, and I played again. They stuck me up front with Lee Nogan, and it was quite ironic, because by then I'd signed for Livingston, and I was actually playing in a 4-3-3 in almost like a sitting midfield role. So to say I was a long way from being a striker then was an understatement, but it just shows you that, you know, old habits die hard. I went up front with Lee, and the same runs and touches and shouts and stuff like that. And within 10 minutes, even though I was playing with a chronic hangover, I might add, it actually went quite well.
Excellent, excellent. So as you mentioned, you go to Hibs, you have a great season, you get promoted. And it's a success from that. I think you reached a Scottish Cup final. You stayed up in Scotland. You ended up moving to Livingston as well, and you won a Scottish Cup up there. I mean, what was some of your, was that your peak moment of your football career, winning that League Cup?
Well, it's funny because the Cup final is actually coming up this weekend. My old club Hibs are playing against Ross County in the League Cup final, and I've been invited along by the SPFL to go along as a guest. So I'll go along, and I dare say there'll be similarities, because when we won that cup with Livingston, it was bizarre. I think Hibs had 40,000 fans there and Livingston had 8,000 fans, because if you've ever, Livingston is a strange place. It's kind of stuck in between Glasgow and Edinburgh, and half the people who live there are from Glasgow and the other half are from Edinburgh. And there's not really anyone who can identify with Livingston, because it's a new town, a bit like Milton Keynes or something like that. So, yeah, we had a tiny portion of the crowd, and it'll probably be similar this weekend with Hibs and Ross County. But yeah, I was very confident going into the game, and I was club captain, and it was great to be able to lead the team, and fantastic to be able to lift the trophy. It would rank very highly. Honestly, I still feel that the season that we won the league when I was at Reading was my most enjoyable, because it was my hometown club, and that's nothing matches that, really. So it's hard to kind of weigh up what achievements that one's better than the other, but that was the first medal that I ever won in my career, and it was with a team that I'd come through the ranks with. So the 93-94 season when we won the league was probably my favourite.
I was going to say, what was more satisfying then, winning an Edinburgh derby or winning one of those fierce Reading Swindon contests?
I tell you what, if you go to an Edinburgh derby, they're pretty tasty. I was lucky; I had a really good record in them, there's a very famous game up here, the 6-2 game that is a favourite of Hibs fans that I played in, when funnily enough Miksu scored a hat trick that day, and that's one of, if you speak to Hibs fans, that's one of their favourite ones, probably not dissimilar to the 3-0 win over Swindon. But any derby is, if you get it, if you understand derbies, I think they're games for the fans far more than the players. You just got to make sure as a player that you actually understand that, and that you give the fans what you want. And over the years, derbies were actually pretty good to me.
So we've got a few questions to ask you. Just before we do that, just very briefly touch on the end of your career. So you move on to Queen of the South. That's where you end your playing days. Did you retire on your terms? Was it your decision to walk away, or would you have maybe liked another season?
No, it was my decision. I was 34. Was I ready to finish? Not really. I mean, I could have carried on playing. To be honest, I was still in pretty good nick, and I was ready. And I had a couple of offers. I'd been offered to go to Partick Thistle, who were a decent team in the second tier. And I was thinking, shall I, shan't I? But then, I'd been doing some TV work up in Scotland, and a lot of stuff for the BBC, and a guy called Rob McLean, who's a well-known presenter up here, became a good friend of mine, and he contacted me and said, look, I'm working with Satanta now, and they've got the rights for the SPL, so we're looking for someone who's got experience of playing, but we want them to develop in the role as a reporter, trackside reporter, doing post-match interviews and features and stuff like that. And I was very interested in media and journalism, and I thought it was a good pathway, so I kind of didn't really see the point. And, I'd made over 500 appearances, and I thought, well, if I carry on playing, why am I doing it? It wasn't really for anything other than just, ticking a box, really. So I thought, no, I've had a good career, I need to learn to start to do something else. And that was the reason I stopped.
Did coaching never tempt you?
I did my coaching badges. I mean, I thought about it, like a lot of players. I did my UEFA B license and my A license, and I contemplated that for a little while, but the problem is I still don't trust people who run football clubs. I don't think they understand the game. I don't think they understand what is required, to put a team together and to manage it. And I think that the immense pressure that these people are under is just you know, it's just crazy at times. And I wouldn't want to put myself in that position or my family. I thought if I did it, it would be for selfish reasons. And there's not much security in it. So I don't regret not going into that side of things.
So you mentioned you end up in the media, do bits. Viewers down here, south of the border, would have seen you on Sky Sports News a few times as well, doing coverage there. You had a newspaper column and stuff. But what are you up to now?
So I work full time with the Players Union in Scotland. The PFA is you know, very similar, obviously, in terms of the work that we do compared to the PFA in England. But we're not a joint body. You know, the PFA in England is a separate organisation altogether. I wish we had their money because, they certainly have great funding and get a chunk of money, mainly from the TV deal, obviously, which we don't get. So it's a different game up here. There's obviously far less money swilling around the game in Scotland than there is in England. But I made Edinburgh my home, and Glasgow is where I work. And I really enjoy the job. I mean, it's fascinating. It really is. It's never dull. And it feels, you know, it's a job that's quite enriching at times, because my job is to represent and assist and help players. And so I can stay in the game without the pressures of being a coach or a manager or any of that stuff. So, yeah, I mean, I like the job, and I hope I'm doing it for many years to come.
On the PFA front, when I was doing some research ahead of this interview, I came across a Stuart Lovell betting tips thing for, I think it was the Scottish Sun at the time, and I was reading some of the stories in there about how you'd wandered into a bookies and saw the fact they'd only given you 10-1 odds to score the first goal. So you thought, right, I'll stick some money on that and prove them wrong. And some other interesting stories. I mean, for a punter, you know, we constantly joke on our podcast, hashtag gamble aware. But, you know, unfortunately today it's become a bit, gambling in sport has become a lot more of a serious issue, to the point where I'm not sure what the rule is in Scotland, but I know in England now it's banned if you're involved in the top professional tiers. You're not allowed to bet on football, full stop.
Yeah.
Is that something you support? Do you think it has become an issue?
Well, I guess I can see it from both sides. I mean, it would be a bit hypocritical of me, you know, as someone who likes to have a bet and, you know, who used to write a column for one of the papers, to, you know, to say that I disapprove of it. I guess I understand that the football authorities are trying to have a blanket ban for the integrity of the sport. My personal opinion is that no player should ever be thinking about betting on games that they're playing in. If you want to take that a degree further, you maybe say you shouldn't be betting in your division, or maybe even in your country. You know, to stop players betting on games worldwide, I think is a little bit OCD, but I do understand why they do it. The different perspective is that, you know, some of the football authorities have tried to argue that they're doing it to help players. And I'm thinking, well, there's not much they ever do to help players. And this certainly isn't it, because football's not the only thing you can bet on, you know. And you can have an addiction and bet on horses or golf or tennis or any sport you like. So, I'm not sure about some of their motives behind it, but we actually had the rules in place in Scotland a long, long time before they did in England.
I think we're
coming up for 10 years now that players in Scotland have not been able to bet on football worldwide. So in a way, it actually caused some problems, because one of the players who was banned a couple of years ago or last season was Steve Simonson, who was made his name playing in England, the goalkeeper, and moved to Rangers. And he got banned on the basis that he thought the rules in Scotland were the same as in England. And he didn't bet on his team and he didn't bet on his division. And he thought, well, I'm okay doing that. And he got shopped by someone in Ladbrokes, and the rest is history.
Oh, wow.
It's
probably a Celtic fan if he was playing for England at the time. I'm going to put a limb out there.
Quite possibly.
Okay. So great that you're staying in the game and doing some really good stuff. I've got a few questions. I said you are still a very popular man amongst the Reading fan base, so I'll try and rattle through with you. One question that was asked from Will was, would you have actually moved back to Reading if you'd had an offer later in your career?
This is probably the wrong answer, but no. I'm a great believer in never go back. I remember speaking to Adie, you know, when he went back. And I said to him, are you sure about this? You know, it's never the same the second time around. And it worked out pretty well for him, so I'm sure he thought it was the right decision. But I'm very much someone that the past is the past. And, you know, I look back on my time at Reading very fondly. But would I want to have gone back to the club in any capacity? Not really.
A couple of people have asked, what was your favourite goal you scored for Reading? And on a similar edge, if it's a different goal, what was your most satisfying?
Oh, that's tricky. I guess my favourite goal, what I think technically was my best goal, was the season we won the league. And I scored a volley against Hartlepool at Elm Park. It was a really nice move, you know, typical kind of build-up play that we used to do under Mark McGee, a lot of one-touch football, and then the ball was played to Mick Gooding. And Mick wasn't known for his vision and his quality of pass, but he hit a fantastic long ball over the centre-back's shoulder. And I just kind of took off and just managed to break the offside trap, and it came over my shoulder, and I was probably 18 yards out. And it was an incredibly difficult ball to even control, so I thought, I'll just hit it first time. And to be honest, anything could have happened, but I caught it absolutely perfectly and lobbed the goalkeeper as he came out. I have to say it was a brilliant finish. So that was technically, it was probably my best goal. Most important?
Or satisfying, or, yeah.
Or satisfying. I mean, that would have to be the winning goal against Wolves in the, you know, in the dying embers of the game. You know, we pulled that out of the fire, and it was probably a little bit sweeter because it was against my previous manager as well, Mark McGee.
Yeah. Another question. Does Archie know that there's an Archie Lovell fan club in the Czech Republic? I can't corroborate this. I'm just being told this.
I've not been to the Czech Republic, so okay. That's news to me. If there is one.
Get your tweets into at the Tarlas and we'll pass it along to Archie.
That's quite flattering. I'm interested to know who started that.
I will follow up on that one. Another question. Is it true Archie once went to the theatre thinking it would be the one place where he wouldn't encounter football fans, but still ended up being approached by a Reading fan?
Yeah, that is true. Yeah, there was no hiding place for me. You know, my wife jokes about it now, but I mean, there were lots of reasons why we moved away from Reading, but part of the reason was that she was sick and tired that when we used to go out, I always used to get recognised. So she said, this place is a goldfish bowl and I want to go somewhere else.
Were you ever part of the infamous Utopia crew? We questioned Shaka about this and he was very tight-lipped.
Oh, was he? Well,
he mentioned that you were in there a fair, not you personally, but the team were in there a fair bit.
Yeah, I mean, we didn't have great choice. And let's not forget, I mean, you know, this was a Tuesday night that generally we used to go. So we would have we always used to have a double session on a Tuesday, and then we would go out usually as a pretty decent sized group. You know, it was quite a young squad back then. So yeah, I will confess to being part of that group, and then paying for it usually on a Wednesday, which was a day off. But I was always, you know, ready to hit the ground running when we were back in on a Thursday.
As a local lad, any other favourite establishments at the time?
Well, I wasn't really, you know, your typical footballer in that I didn't tend to kind of frequent the tacky clubs. I was quite happy going to the, you know, places like the After Dark. You know, I liked my indie music and stuff like that. So I wasn't really someone that used to be too interested in going to, you know, dance nightclubs. You know, I was quite happy going to the Purple Turtle and the After Dark and places like that.
You'll be pleased to hear both of those are still going.
I'm not surprised. You know, they had a great following, you know, back in the day, and you know, they were great. The type of music they played was why they were so busy, and it doesn't surprise me they're still around.
Yeah, the Purple Turtles had a very extensive renovation recently, but I think the After Dark probably hasn't been decorated since your time.
Yeah,
I think that
doesn't surprise me either.
No, I imagine there'll be a few Reading fans if we end up beating Crystal Palace. I say this podcast will go out afterwards, so can be feel free to amend this as appropriate. and yeah, just overall, What was your favourite just moment in general at the club?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, to understand that you need to be a local lad. You know, like I mean, I wasn't born in Reading, but you know, I went to primary school, secondary school, you know, and I came through every part of the ranks that they had. You know, I mean, as I said earlier, Reading were one of the first clubs to have a proper academy, and I joined, you know, from the day dot. So to be able to play for your local club, I think is a great thing, and and we had a fair amount of success. You know, I mean, I was there as a full-time player at Reading for 10 years, you know, 2 years as an apprentice and 8 years as a pro. And, you know, we had some really good seasons. You know, I mean, the most obvious ones were the two back-to-back seasons under Mark McGee, you know, when we won the league and then got to the playoff final at Wembley. They were obviously the most successful. But there were some, you know, there were some good times apart from that, and some pretty bleak ones as well. And I think that's probably that is the life of a journeyman footballer, I'm afraid. You know, as I've said before, you take the good with the bad. And but I think when you look back on your career at any club, you do tend to remember the really memorable days and the successful seasons. And all the rest of the stuff just falls by the wayside, really.
As I said, you are much loved. Dave Handbags Harris, one of our co-hosts here on the Tarleton podcast, has said, more of a point rather than a question, points will be offered to Archie on the basis of that hat-trick against Swindon and for the piss-taking celebration afterwards. So anytime you come down here, give Dave Harris a nudge and you'll be well and truly looked after. But before we let you go then, thanks again very much for giving us your time. What do you make of Reading now? Obviously, it's been nearly 20 years. Well, it has been 20 years since you left the club,
yeah.
Give or take. What have you made of Reading in the time since then?
Well, I mean, I was delighted when they eventually got promoted to the Premier League because, as you can imagine, that was a monkey off my back. So I think I've got Steve Coppell and that squad to thank for... you know, for that phenomenal achievement. And I think that's still the record points total, isn't it, for a team being promoted from the... Yeah, so they, I mean, you know, that was very enjoyable to watch because, you know, Reading is still the first result that I look for every weekend. And and I think from that perspective, my penalty miss became far less of an issue.
once people were finally allowed to watch that playoff final again.
Well, I think the thing is once the club had played in the Premier League, and I know it was only relatively short lived, but I have a feeling that they might be back there before too long, and then the longer it goes on, the less painful it is for fans of my era, you know, talking about that playoff final. Which, I mean, listen, you know, you never quite get over it, but Reading have had some pretty good times since then, haven't they?
Yeah, we've been quite lucky. We've been to the Premier League twice, and as I said, I'm sat here about to record the day before an FA Cup quarter final. I think it's our fourth in the space of 6 years, so not done too bad. And fingers crossed, we can get back there. Do you still get down? Do you get back to the town very often?
Not much. No, I will be down this summer because a very good friend of mine is getting married at the end of June. So he is having his, we're not allowed to say stag because you're not actually allowed to have a stag do at Royal Ascot.
But oh, okay.
We're both keen race goers. So he's decided that we will be going to Royal Ascot for a few days. So yeah, I will be flying down in June and staying in an establishment in the centre of town and, you know, reminding myself of the good places to go, and I'm sure it'd be great fun.
Well, as I said, if you ever want company or someone to buy you free drinks, just tweet us before you before you go out in the town, and I'm sure you will have no shortage of Reading fans who've got nothing but happy memories of your time here.
That's very kind of you. I will keep that in mind.
Please do. Well, as I said, Stuart, thank you very, very much for joining us. Are you active on social media at all?
I'm not, you know, for various reasons, but I think I tend to value my privacy. So that is the main reason I just kind of duck out of it. And I do look at it and think, having seen and having had to represent quite a number of footballers in Scotland over their poor choice of words on social media, I'm well aware of the perils, but I can see the pros, but... yeah, for me, it's something that I tend to steer clear of.
Well, absolutely. Well, until the day that we get Natalie Dormer on this podcast, you have been our most successful Chilton Edge pupil to ever appear on this podcast. So you can certainly wear that as a badge of honour. And I said, thank you very, very much for taking the time to join us. And I said, for everything you did for the football club, it was a great time. I said, as a very young fan, watching you score some cracking goals, and great that you had such a fantastic career afterwards and you're still active in the game.
Well, I appreciate you asking me to come on. It's been really good fun reminiscing. And obviously, I hope that, you know, the current Reading fans have got something to celebrate in the last couple of months of the season. Maybe even a FA Cup final, perhaps. That would be nice.
You'll absolutely have to come to it if we get there.
I think I might. If they make it to Wembley, I think I might have to come down.
Please do. Right, as I said, Stuart, thank you very much for joining us and take care.
Great stuff. Thank
Cheers.
You.
Bye.
The Tarlhurst End Podcast.
By Reading fans, for Reading fans.